Thank you. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. The time is 1:35 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Chair Thompson, myself, Representative Newman. Representative Munoz, I do expect the other members shortly. Today we're going to continue with the department overviews. First up is the Department of Corrections, followed by the Department of Law. I'd like to invite Commissioner Designee Williams up to the table and ask him to begin his presentation. And members, I like the conversations that we have when we're doing these. If we could just be cognizant of that as we move along, that would be good. And then just so we make sure it's the presentation, we have two today, but I do want to allow for that. Commissioner.
Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, I'm Commissioner Designee Dean Williams. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. And it is breaking in a new commissioner, and I'm the new guy on the block. So thank you. My able-bodied assistant, April Wilkerson, is here. She's going to go launch through the details. If there's questions you have for either April or I, we certainly entertain those and look forward to talking to you about our budget, and as well as anything else you might have about curiosity about my vision for the department or anything like that. I know this is a budget overview, but if you have questions for me about anything where we're going, entertain that as well as at your pleasure. So, April, if you would, please.
Thank you. And Ms. Wilkerson and Commissioner, if we can try and keep answers to members, you know, direct as we can, so we can allow for the maximum amount of questions of time
sure.
available.
For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. My name is April Wilkerson, Director of Admin Services for the Department of Corrections. On slide two, we have the mission of the department. And the overall mission of the department is to provide safe communities, and that's completed through secure confinement, reformative programming, and a process of supervised release. The department is structured with five specific divisions. There's the Division of Institutions, the Division of Probation and Parole, which are overseen by the Deputy Commissioner of Operations. And then we also have a Deputy Commissioner that oversees the Health and Rehabilitation Services, as well as the Division of Administrative Services. We also have the Parole Board that points directly to the Commissioner, and those are appointed by the Governor's Office. Alaska is one of six unified states. We operate both jails and prisons. In 2015, we booked into our facilities just over 36,000 individuals, of which 21,700 were unique individuals. And then we also had just over 3,500, which were Title 47s or non-criminal holds. That is an increase over last year, and we're continuing to work with local communities to try and reduce that number.
Just a clarification. So the 3,557 that are Title 47, is that included in the 36,000?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, yes, it is.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Just April, the unified correctional system, does that mean one for the whole state, or does that imply that if you have local jails and longer-term prisons, that's a definition of unified? What's that mean?
The state, our correctional centers, through the chair to Representative Sadler, our correctional centers house both pretrial and they also house sentenced facilities or sentenced offenders, and jail facilities are usually those that are awaiting pretrial or have been sentenced to a term of 2 years or less.
Thank you.
As of June 15th, we did have just over 6,000 individuals that were housed in some capacity, whether that was within an institution, in a CRC placement, or on electronic monitoring. And we did have just over 6,500 individuals within the community that were under supervised probation or parole.
Thank you.
We do have 12 facilities statewide with a capacity of just over 5,300. That includes the 128 beds that are currently offline within the Point McKenzie Correctional Farm. Our average daily population was 5,122 at $141 a day. The department has 13 field probation offices throughout the state, and we also operate and contract with four community residential centers at 8 different locations. We have electronic monitoring within 6 communities, and those are Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, Kenai, and Palmer. We did have an average daily capacity last year at 450 on some type of EM, and that was at a cost to the department of just over $21.40 per day. We continue to contract with 15 local community jails throughout the state with 157 bed capacity, and we did utilize those at about 80. There was an average daily placement within those facilities of about 80 for an average daily cost of just over $350. And then we also process and continue to provide reformative programming such as substance abuse, sex offender management, education, vocational education.
Representative Kalasan.
Sure. I didn't see further in the slides discussing specifically the community, the CRCs. How often are those contracts looked at? For Fairbanks, I know the Fairbanks one, it just seems like every 2 weeks there's a flight of a prisoner or somebody that's supposed to be supervised at that particular CRC. I haven't seen that in other regions or other areas that have a residential center.
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, we have 5-year contracts with each of those individuals, but we do have terms and conditions. We are continuing to work specifically with the Fairbanks Community Residential Center, as well as one located in Anchorage, to firm up and to address the issues that we currently have in both of those locations.
Thanks.
Representative Gutler.
Thank you. The residential facility in Fairbanks, I don't know if the fire marshals have gotten in touch with you. They have complained repeatedly that they don't even respond to fire alarms, false alarms out there. That is, it is, there's two facilities. There's the existing facility and trailers behind it. The trailers are apparently not a problem, but the facility itself is very problematic. Doesn't have sprinklers, which is code. The fire alarm system goes off repeatedly have false alarms out there. They don't even go out there anymore. There's a vast number of complaints and fire code violations that they cite them all the time. And there's a public safety issue that if it hasn't got to you, if you haven't looked at it yet, you might just call the Fairbanks Fire Marshals and get some feedback from them on what the issue is.
Through the chair to Representative Gutenberg, thank you. We will follow up with that. On slide 6 is a map that lists out each of the institutions and the regional community jails and where they are located. Slide 7 lists each of our probation offices, the community residential centers, and the electronic monitoring programs and the locations that they are located at. We do also offer electronic monitoring through the community regional jail contracts. However, there are some issues with some of the locations due to GPS availability in the rural areas.
Representative Gutberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Representative Wilson has pointed out. I've done this in the past. Last year when we were having a conversation about ankle bracelets, I opened up my iPhone, and I found an app in a minute that is as restricted as controlling as an ankle bracelet. And over the years, I've gotten complaints from people that they couldn't go to work because they had an ankle bracelet, and they couldn't go to work on the North Slope. If you had the app or a contractor that would run that on an iPhone, people could go to work and still be, I mean, the North Slope is covered, Prudhoe Bay area is covered in a service area. It's very controlling. It ring fences. It does reporting. But if you have an ankle bracelet, you can't go to work. You could probably have a great number more people that are out, being productive, waiting trial or sentencing, if you had a vendor that would use that apparatus. Because everybody's got iPhones. Up there, everybody's on phones all the time. So you might look into that as a cost savings, keeping people out of jail, having jobs.
Through the chair. Through the chair. Thank you.
If I may comment, Mr. Chairman, really briefly, this whole area of ankle, through the chair, Representative Gutenberg and anyone else, this whole area of electronic monitoring, I'm a little bit early on yet right now to understand where our bugs are at and where the advantages are at. There's huge advantages, we know, in terms of electronic monitoring and pretrial efforts to all the work that we're going to be doing that's in front of us right now on this area is hugely important to me as the new commissioner designee. I can just tell you that it's going to take me a while to get my head around about where the glitches are at and where we're spending money. We've made good progress. I've talked to people already in the first week on the job about what we're doing about it, because I think a lot of our future lies upon keeping people who have gotten into trouble somehow back attached to the community, attached to jobs, attached to the social network, so things don't go downhill further for these folks. So it's a huge area of concern, and I'm all over, and I'm a big believer that the future for us is doing everything we can to expand our capacity in this area while doing it safely. And both of those things are very important. So just not for nothing in terms of where my head and heart is at in regards to this issue.
Representative Agin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to take a very slight detour, I know this is a budget presentation, but in that vein, in our next subcommittee hearing, we are going to focus the subcommittee's attention on Senate Bill 91 and all the reforms that are being proposed and that major piece of legislation that hopefully we get an opportunity to consider here at this committee. So.
Thank you, Representative. Go ahead.
On slide 78, the department's budget is broken out based on the core services that we provide, which are the three primary functions of secure confinement, reformative programming, and supervised release. Secure confinement does consume the largest portion of the department's budget at 77%, with reformative programming at just 7%, and supervised release being 16%. The fund source that make up the department's budget, again, is primarily general funds. I believe that Department of Corrections is the third largest agency in the state that is general funded. We do have some federal funds that are supported primarily through billing a federal entity for those federal holds that are placed in the department's custody. And then we do have some designated general funds, which are primarily just over $20 million, is the permanent fund dividend criminal funds. And then we have a small portion that's made up through billing of local municipalities for those local holds that are placed within the department's custody, as well as electronic monitoring collections and collections of wages through the community and residential centers for those individuals that are in working.
Representative Thompson and Ms. Wilkinson, you're fourth behind university corrections.
I just wanted to go back through the designated general funds again. You said that was permanent fund dividends?
Through the chair to Representative Thompson, that is correct. The Department of Corrections receives permanent fund dividend criminal funds for those individuals that are ineligible to collect a PFD. Those funds are one of the fund sources that support the physical health care and the medical services that the department provides.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are your designated general funds?
Designated general, through the chair to Representative Wilson, we have just over $20 million is through the permanent fund, criminal funds. We have about $2.3 million that is through the billing of the local municipalities. I believe it's $2.5 million. And then we have another $1.7 million, which is electronic monitoring receipts. And then we have another $1.3 million, I believe, which is through wage collections from the CRCs.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So, and not just on the slides, but more of the previous slides, it's good to know how many people that are attached to each one of your core missions, but I need the understanding of how many people in that program. So we kind of have an understanding where, you know, I know for jails it takes a certain number to each, you know, employee you would have. Ankle monitors would have something different. And then you have your parole where some are ankle monitored, some aren't. But I know you, I don't know whether or not the department has like best practices of how many you hope to have with each person to the reality of what you do have. So just some numbers of who we're talking about in each one of those programs would help us understand better on the budget.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question in regards to the ankle monitor receipts. So hearing the commissioner speak about trying to give opportunities for people to basically go to work. And so what I'm really asking, I think that there are companies that actually charge to handle the ankle monitoring. So are we adding a fee on top of it so that we, the state, we, you guys, are getting actually receipts from those folks that are on ankle monitors on top of what the businesses are charging?
Through the chair to Representative Gaddis, those individuals that are placed on electronic monitoring under the department's program do not pay the vendor directly. They are paying for the equipment, and I believe it's about $14 a day for the equipment and then $10 a week for the UAs. It comes out to just over $100 per week, and that is paid directly back to the Department of Corrections. The department does have the authority for a sliding scale to if an individual is doing well and they can't quite afford the full.
I guess all that being said is, are we making money off of our prisoners, or are we breaking even in that regard?
Through the chair to Representative Gaddis, the electronic monitoring receipts are just over 46%. We're not breaking even on that program.
Okay.
So it's general funds as well as the receipt driven.
We're losing money. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative Gaddis, the alternative of a CRC or them staying in a hard bed is much more costly to the state than being placed on electronic monitoring.
I don't think she cares, and I don't think we care. We just want to cover the costs. Representative Gaddis.
Couldn't have said it better. So I'm going to try again. And Commissioner, I think you know where I'm coming from.
Right.
So what I'm trying to do is say, on the vein of helping our prisoners use that stepladder out of where they are to be able to get into society, have jobs, it is my opinion that we don't want, I mean, if anything, we break even or even lose money, but we certainly would not want to add an additional layer to where we're going to collect money. Because that's what I hear out there is that it costs our folks a lot of money. It's like, dang, you know, not only am I having a hard time, but now you guys are making it even harder. And I, once I'm in this spiral, I can't get out. So back to my question is, I certainly understand a bed is more expensive than the ankle monitor, and we're not comparing that. Ankle monitor, are we breaking even or are we making money on those designated receipts in regards to the ankle monitor? And I know it's a small amount of money, but I think it goes to the what the commissioner has spoken about is, are we really helping folks get a leg up, or are we ourselves, we state, are we really putting our folks down, making it really difficult to get out? Big question.
Go ahead, and I'll follow up.
Through the chair to Representative Gaddis. We try and work with individuals that are having a difficult time to ensure that they can stay on electronic monitoring because it is, the process is more
Mr.
beneficial.
Chair, I'll just be real quick. Are we making money or not? This is a yes or a no.
Through We're not making money on
this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner, is it your intention to put policies into place where prisoners who are out on ankle monitor can deal directly with the businesses that supply those, as opposed to going through the Department of Corrections where you have to have extra personnel to do the accounting and all the monitoring? Are you in the process of putting together a program where they can work directly with the people who provide these?
Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you what my commitment is on this whole issue. I want this done with the greatest efficiency, the least cost, the most sensible way in doing it. I'm uncomfortable with charging people as fundamental, philosophically, because we know that electronic monitoring, keeping people outside versus inside the jail, is cheaper. It's usually better for the individual, assuming we can assure safety within the community. So I don't have a strong opinion which is the most efficient way yet with 1 week on the job, but I can tell you I'm looking for the most efficient and effective way. And if a private contractor can do that, I'm for that. If we can do it cheaper, I'm for that. But I'm looking for the most efficient, effective way of reducing prison populations. Electronic monitoring is the way forward if we can do this wisely and safely. So when I see all of you hopefully next year, we will have a plan on this that I'm comfortable with saying this is the way we're going, because I think this should be increased. It's better for the individual who's in trouble, and most of the time, I want all the time it to be.
Commissioner, we get it.
Yep.
We get it.
Yep.
It's cheaper to do it that way.
Right.
And in your opinion, a lot of times it's better. The concern of the committee is the fact that we have administrative operations going within your department that cost the state of Alaska, so that we have to try and to decide whether we're going to spend money doing that or put money towards Alaska State Troopers on the road. I think we'd rather have troopers on the road. So what I think we're asking you is to come back with a plan that changes this program to where the individuals who are wearing the ankle bracelets can pay directly to the people who are supplying them.
Mr. Chairman, I get it. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to be careful that we don't have people actually want to go to jail so that they can have the department pay for it instead. When we're talking about pre-sentence right now, you can go on the ankle monitor based on a bill last year. And if you can't pay, then there's money in health and social services for helping those who can't afford to pay. But I just want to make sure, and maybe this is something that the subcommittee could talk about. We're only talking about those pre-sentence who actually, for whatever reason, end up in jail, become part of the Department of Corrections, and then they determine, again, by the same rules, to those who can and can't pay. So it's not whether they're making money or not making money. There is a fairness test that has to be done by the courts on if you can pay, you will pay. If you can't, there are other means to be able to do it. But I just met with the commissioner, and I have no doubt that he is going to use everything to his resources so that not just to get not so that they're not just in jail, but that they get on the path to recovery faster, don't lose their house, don't lose their jobs, but yet keep them safe as well. So that's probably a committee for the subcommittee to talk about. But when we're talking out of jail and in jail, we just want to make sure we're not directing people to go to jail first, because I think there's more benefit cost-wise, because it definitely doesn't benefit us.
Thank you. Representative Edgman, if you could just wrap this up when we're done in your committee and you can deal with it then and look at it. Yes. Thank you.
Much more to be said about it.
Go ahead.
The operating budget by line item is primarily personal services. We're at 59%. We do have 33% in our services and then 7% in our commodities, with 1% being travel related. Our travel is primarily for point of arrest and prisoner transports. Within the commissioner's office, the total budget is $3.2 million, and that is all 100% general funds. The commissioner's office itself is just at $1.3 million, with 7 positions tied to that. That also includes the training academy at $1.4 million, with 7 PCNs. And then we do have the recidivism reduction program that's within the department's budget at $500,000. Those are contracts with Department of Health and Social Services. The Division of Institution is made up with inmate classification and furlough, which of the total budget of $212 million is $1.5 million in nine positions, and it is 100% general funds within the classification and furlough. They oversee and classify inmates for appropriate placements as well as community placements after their term of imprisonment. We also include the Inmate Transportation Unit. That is a delegated authority from the Department of Public Safety, and that unit operates at $2.9 million and 11 PCNs. We are reimbursed for $140,000 from Public Safety to assist us with our prisoner transports. Our delegated authority is between institutions and for medical appointments, and all other transports are handled by the Public Safety. The 12 correctional centers are the biggest user of the funding that's allocated within this division at $186 million and just over 1,390 positions. The department also has a statutory obligation for returning prisoners to the point of arrest, and that unit is just over 600,000 general funds. And then we also have the education and vocational education within institutions at just over 1.6 million, and the regional and community jails of $7 million.
While we're on that issue on vocational education programs, I see that reform programs as part of your mission statement. Can you tell us what you're doing currently to try and educate prisoners so that they can enter back into the workforce?
We are providing basic education along with, our general education diplomas. We are trying to ensure that all inmates have a GED or high school diploma. We are providing basic education. And then in addition to that, we are also providing several apprenticeship programs in construction and other training opportunities through apprenticeship programs and contracts throughout all the state. We can provide a full listing of all of those types of programs to the chair.
That's what I'd like, is a list of the programs that you're doing, their costs, and where they're locating at.
Absolutely.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think to add to that list, if I could, I heard the word, and I'm going to paraphrase it. I think it was like we're attempting to get folks who are GED, but really what I'm asking is how many folks came in without a GED and how many did you actually get? So I'm like, so could we provide on those apprentice programs how many actually actually graduated, whatever the term is? And, you know, I've spoken to the commissioner about actually having completion certificates and something that's useful outside of the prison. And so what I'm really curious about is I certainly think the GED certificate is useful, but I'm looking at what other useful certificates that we can actually – they can use to go to the outside world and basically get a job. So, you know – versus attempting, I'd like to see actually how graduation rates. Thanks.
Through the chair, we can get that. On slide 13 is our Division of Health and Rehabilitation. That budget is just over $47 million. Within the physical health care, it is the biggest user of those funds at $30 million and 141 positions. And that oversees all of the medical, both within the institutions and outside services as are identified and approved, including the dental care. Behavioral health is just over $8.4 million and it's 54 positions. And we operate and oversee all the mental health services within the unit. We do have subacute units within Anchorage and in Seward. And then we have acute units at Palmer, and then we also have the subacute unit at the female facility in Highland Mountain. We also operate out of that budget the Assess, Plan, Identify APIC program, and then we have the IDP Plus for community placements of those mentally ill offenders. The substance abuse program is also within this division at $4.6 million and two positions. That's primarily contract services throughout the state. We have the sex offender management program.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you tell me how Medicaid expansion has affected the bottom line in healthcare services this year compared to last year?
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, we currently have just over 50 individuals that have been approved for Medicaid expansion, and so those invoices and those billings will be direct billed by the provider instead of the department paying those bills. through the unallocated process, the department did take a $1.5 million reduction to the physical health care budget in anticipation of avoiding those costs.
And is that, Mr. Chairman, is that an accurate calculation of what your savings might be?
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, with a full year operations, the department is expecting between $7 to $7.5 million of potential cost avoidance or savings and being able to reduce the department's budget. We did in the 16 unallocated apply a $1.5 million reduction, and then in the FY17 numbers that is reflective of an additional $6 million reduction for the first full year after working out the bugs.
A little clarification on that, Representative Munoz. Here's how I remember it, is the department submitted a budget from the governor that had a $4 million decrement, and there was concerns. We talked to the other members here about that in reducing not just corrections but Department of Public Safety's budget at a time when we thought that their customers were going to increase dramatically because of other instances, other things going on in the state, lots of jobs, basically. So we didn't reduce that. And so this committee put $4 million we backfilled in UGF to cover that. Medicaid expansion did expand because they were going to get the $4 million from Medicaid expansion to cover that. Medicaid expansion was implemented by the governor's office on that. So they basically got an extra $4 million. So what happened is when they took their share of the $30 million of unallocated reductions through OMB that we did for contract for increases in salaries last year, they used that $4 million to backfill their share of the unallocated reduction. Is that right?
To the chair, that is correct.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember reading a story once about the San Quentin superintendent or warden, Clinton Duffy, who had a problem with a lot of substance abuse in his prisoner population, but had no budget. So he allowed the NA and AA meetings into his facility and had great success. So my question is, you on the substance abuse program for $4.6 million, is that 12-step programs or is that some other kind of program? And can you have any assessment of what's most effective?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler. Those are short-term and long-term programs. We do have what's called a residential treatment program, which is a six-month program, and then we also have 90-day programs throughout various institutions as well.
So to what extent do you let the prisoners participate in 12-step programs?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler. Those nonprofit organizations are within the majority, if not all, of our institutions, and that could be a part of what we provide to the committee, showing where in those 12-step programs are offered.
Okay.
Thank you. We have Representative Wilson, then Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it true that we don't accept private insurance if someone has it?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, the Department of Corrections doesn't. If we can identify quickly enough, we will have the hospitals bill directly on those insurance, but most insurance providers quickly were unable to do a third-party billing at this time. We're hoping with the electronic system that we're putting into place, that will assist the department in securing reimbursement for those that have insurance when they come into the facilities.
Follow up.
Representative Wilson.
So once you're able to do that, would that also include if a doctor visit was done at the facility, or would it only be included if they were taken to the hospital?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, I'm unsure of that. I would have to get back to you with those details.
Okay. I appreciate that, because we've asked that question before, and I have never been able to understand why if someone has private insurance that we wouldn't accept that.
Thank you. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm going back to the substance abuse programs. So, I mean, it would seem to me that your 90-day and your six-month programs, they clearly work while they're in jail for the obvious reasons. But do you have any anecdotal evidence that they work when they get out of jail? I mean, that's the bigger struggle. I mean, do you actually have data that shows that those programs are working?
Through the chair to Representative Gaddis, I'll need to gather that information and provide it back to the committee.
Versus, if you will, the nonprofit or the AA or the 12-step programs, and I think that might have been what Representative Sadler was also thinking about. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Gaddis, on that point, I believe the $500,000 that you have for contractual obligations is to, through the University of Alaska, to do the reports on copying where that money, following out where those people went and to see how effective that was so that we know the plans that we're implementing, we can improve on them. Correct?
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up on Representative Gaddis and one follow-up on Representative Wilson's questions. On substance abuse treatment, I mean, there is some science to it. Like, the 12-step AA program works for some people. Some people need 30-day treatment. Some people need 6-month treatment. And but Alaska is, and it doesn't sound like you have anything more than 6-month treatment. What do you do for the people who are screened and they need 12-month treatment? Do they just not get it and they come out the same as they were when they came in?
Through the chair to Representative Garrett, I need to get that information from our clinician that oversees the program. We used to provide a 12-month program, and that has been reduced to 6 months for various reasons. And they are intensive cognitive, and they're evidence-based programs. But I'd like to get that information to you to show why we went from that 12-month program down to the 6.
Thank you, through the chair.
President Garrett?
Yeah, I'd like to know that, because if a 6-month program is not what is appropriate for you and a 12-month is, and you're wasting your money on a 6-month, then it would be confusing to me. And then on what Representative Wilson asked, I'm a little flabbergasted. So there is some sense among some committee members, and I'm not always there, but I am right now, that business as usual just happened. So why would we be in the year 2016 and still not be billing private insurance when it's available? I mean, why is that something that we need an electronic system to deal with?
Through the record, through the chair, to Representative Guerra. It's not some information that is really forthcoming, and we need that electronic database to be able to tie someone back to their private insurance. Basically, inmates, the offenders that come into our custody, aren't really willing to provide us that information.
Through the chair, just so I have
Representative Garrett.
So is it only the cases where a prisoner says, I'm not giving you that information, that you don't have it, or are there cases where you could get the information from them and their private insurance is still not being billed?
Through the chair, to Representative Guerra, we have not in the past historically tried to bill where there is insurance. If we can find and we have that information, we will encourage the provider, but if the insurance doesn't pay or the person doesn't approve that payment, then the providers will bill the department and we will pay that. And I can provide and identify some historical information and the obstacles that we have run into before.
Just finally, Mr. Yeah. So stuff like this, I'm one that says cut waste, don't cut things further than waste and duplication. And I'm having a hard time because every time I'm trying to shore up and protect a department like yours, something like this comes up, and even though it's a small amount of money, I've got no defense to it. So I have a hard time advocating for an agency that's not billing available private insurance, even though that's – and so answers like that will lead to cuts in other places that I think are unjustified, but they don't help the department's cause at all.
Mr. Chairman.
It's not your fault, but
– Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'm with you. I think the entire I've been on the job 1 week, but even before I was on the job and doing the review and looking at some of the medical care that's occurring inside the facility and the system we have in place, it needs a whole new look. No condemnation to anybody who's running it now. Nothing against anybody who's running it, who's doing the job they think they have done. But this whole area of the medical care and how we're billing for Medicaid services now that, now some of these folks are going to be eligible, what we're doing in terms of privatization and private insurance, all of these areas need a whole sweep. I don't want to get ahead of myself in terms of what I'm thinking because I haven't talked to the parties yet. It would be inappropriate. It would be unfair. But I'm laser focused on this issue because I want increased care inside the prison system at the reduced cost and the most efficient cost we can have, because the more efficiencies I can get, the better care I can provide for others. And so I'm laser focused on this, and I've seen enough already to know to tell you that I'm concerned, and I'm going to I'm going to work on it.
Representative Edgman. I just got a note from my staff, and it is true that most insurance companies do terminate benefits once somebody gets incarcerated, but I think the other reality is that most of these inmates probably don't have insurance to begin with. I mean, so we're talking about a small amount, and I guess I would take this opportunity to come to the department's defense. They have done a great job in terms of setting up a system where they can track the ingoing and outgoing inmates and setting up a system that really has saved the state a lot of money in terms of health care costs.
Well, while we're on the issue of health care for inmates, how far have we gotten in an effort to try and make sure that inmates are Medicaid eligible upon release?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, we have been working with Health and Social Services. We have been able to work through them. We have recently hired an administrative assistant to help with those applications. It's a much reduced application for the inmates to, rather than the complicated process that was before. It's still not in place, and we have not made any of them eligible at this time.
Not the right answer. We've had Medicaid expansion for over 6 months now. You've got a considerable amount of inmates that would qualify for this. They're getting out of prison, stepping out of that gate with absolutely no assistance, yet we're providing the funding or at least the ability to try and get assistance for that, and you're not taking advantage of that. This discussion's been going on between me and the two departments for at least 3 years. 3 years. The governor expanded Medicaid. The governor's doing all he can to try and make sure he enrolls as many people as you can on Medicaid. Saying that you haven't done it yet is not the right answer. Commissioner, any comments?
Mr. Chairman, getting these folks on Medicaid is extremely important, hands down. There's no qualifier. It's extremely important.
Get it done. Representative Wilson.
Sorry for asking this, Skip, but as you just brought that up. So if someone is pretrial but they're in the correction system and you start using electronic monitoring within your system, so they're out working, getting therapy, would they then be eligible for Medicaid expansion, or would they be under the correction system because it's not like they could get medical without going somewhere else? So do you know whether or not if they're on electronic monitoring as part of your monitoring, not private monitoring, would they be Medicaid expansion eligible? Because that's a huge extra savings.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we do not cover individuals that are on electronic monitoring on their medical. We only cover those individuals that are incarcerated or in a CRC. If they were eligible, it would depend on their income.
So follow up?
Representative Wilson.
So we're not talking about just pretrial anymore. So if we're even talking about those who have done good time and now they're out on probation, parole, any of those types of things, they would then be Medicaid eligible as long as they're not literally sitting in jail.
Through the chair to Representative, yeah, that is correct.
Okay, a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So can you tell me how many of those, not the ones who've gotten out, but are still underneath your monitoring system in one fashion or another, are now signed up for Medicaid?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we can get that information for you.
Because that's a little different out. We're talking about people still even in the system, so.
We're aware of that. And another issue that we've looked at is discussions that we've had with the department for years, just asking them, are people with it that are incarcerated eligible for Medicaid? The answer we got back for years was no. Yet we had to chase it to the point to prove back to the departments that that was a lie. The fact that in one of your test cases that you're actually working on was a woman who had a pregnancy, was a complicated pregnancy, maybe had issues to do probably before she got into prison. I don't know. But a pregnancy that was very complicated, if they're outside of that prison wall to that gate for 24 hours, Medicaid will cover the cost. And they did, to the tune of about $268,000, if I remember.
For that one.
And she's not the only one. Again, you've expanded this, but yet you're not implementing it into your own department. And we're looking at covering all these other costs. You haven't even brought to us recommendations on what you're going to be doing to try and reduce your costs because of all the options that we just talked about here for the last 20 minutes. Thank you.
On slide 14 is the Division of Probation and Parole. Their budget is just over $47 million with 176 full-time positions, and that includes $17 million that is allocated for the statewide probation and parole covering 13 different regional locations, which a portion of that includes the PACE program, which is currently operating. Currently under the PACE program, we have 377 individuals, and that is offered in Anchorage, Bethel, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, and Palmer. They also have the pre-sentence unit and the interstate compact unit. And then we have electronic monitoring in six locations at $3.4 million. And then the community and residential centers at $26 million.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. I understand we're covering probation and parole here on this one, but it brought me back to thinking on electronic monitoring. The authorization to take pretrial and some of those people to get them so they aren't having the hard bed. How many people do we have on ankle monitors at the present time? And then the second part would be, how many are eligible to be on ankle monitors?
Through the chair to Representative Thompson, we currently have just over 440 individuals that are on electronic monitoring. Those are sentenced individuals. The department doesn't have pre-sentenced individuals on electronic monitoring. And the second part of your question, I'll have to get that to you on those that are currently in a hard bed or in a CRC that are eligible for EM.
Are they eligible? Because that's one of the things that I've heard some comments on, that there's a lot of those people are eligible, but there's been a bit of resistance on the corrections department side to do that, and it brings back the question why. And some of this information that I've had inadvertently coming back to me was that the corrections didn't really want to let them out. They got to keep their employees employed. So that's kind of an odd way of putting it, but that's something I'd like to follow up on.
Through the chair, we can get that.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the PACE program, you told us how many are in it, but I'd like to know what the success rate is in each of the places that you have, because you kind of spotted them out really fast, so I didn't get them all written down. But again, we're just trying to figure out how much it costs and how and whether or not it's working. I'm assuming you're trying to make it so that the inmate they don't come back. The question is, are they and is it cost effective with the amount of money that you're putting into it?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, if we can follow up and respond with that.
Absolutely. Through the co-chair's office, please.
Thank you. The PACE program, Ms. Wilkinson, or Commissioner, the PACE program, is that the program that was instituted to allow zero tolerance for people who are on parole? So if they miss an appointment, if they don't pass a UA, they automatically go back into jail? Is that the PACE program, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, I'm familiar with this program only peripherally, so I'm getting a little over my head. But it's immediate, quick response. That's the program of it. To immediately, that's the strategy behind the program, as I understand it. Yes.
So
So I believe that was the same program we heard from other departments say that was really balling things up and not working.
Mr. Chairman, when I did the review, I heard a high degree of a pretty strong criticism from people that were running the PACE program.
So we're seeing it in your budget?
Well, it's still an operating program, Mr. Chairman, and I be honest with you, I don't know the value of it. I can't give a full analysis. I'm sure there are people here that have strong opinions about it that have been in the department. For me, the job is looking at all of these things under this sky and making sure that they make sense to me. So now that I'm in charge, I'm going to go back to the same people that were had some serious concerns about it, because I heard it directly from them, from the people running the program, to make sure that if it needs changing, if we need to scrap it, whatever needs to be done, that that's what, in fact, gets done.
Commissioner, this body, this committee right here needs to know, and we need to know in a very short period. We'll be asking the same question to the Department of Law, what they think of the PACE when they get here. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Is there a way to request a deputy up here? I get it, you're on a week, on the job for a week, but this is not going to help us with the budget if we can't have answers to our questions. And that is no disrespect, no disrespect. You've been on a week, but we're going to need the answers. And I know you got really capable deputies. Maybe this is an opportunity to invite some of the deputies to join, to throw those lifelines.
Absolutely.
I don't know, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sadler. Thank you.
Ms. Wilkerson, just a brief point. You're giving us good information about the breakout of the cost for each of these functions and the number of PCNs. I would invite you next time you present these charts that you can include that information on there. It would probably save us all a little bit of time and help make the charts a little more useful, just to put the costs and the PCNs down there. Thanks.
Somebody?
Diane Casto, Deputy Commissioner for Operations with the Department of Corrections. I will talk for a minute about PACE. This is a program that I do oversee, and you are correct, there are some controversies about PACE, but it is a national program that does have some very strong evidence that it works. With that said, there are, I believe, some areas that we do need to tighten up. So it is a quick a program where you have quick, swift, consistent consequences. If you are on this program, you're on probation and parole, you go before a judge in Juneau here, it's Judge Pallenberg. He talks to all the PACE newbies and gives them, this is what we're going to do. He gives them an opportunity in the first session to say, you're going to get a UA here in a few minutes. If you're honest with me that we're going to find something, you're going to get a pass this first time. They come in, they're on a regular UA process. If they get a hot UA, they are immediately remanded back to the facility for 3 days. So it's very quick and it's very short. Now, it does, for some people, work. But there are also some people that their addiction overrides them. So I think there needs to be some discussion about who is appropriate for this. With that said, the consternation within our department is with the institutions, because when you bring someone back for a quick 3 days, the institution has to go through get the paperwork, get the file, get them back in, all of that process, which does cause some concern on the institution side. And I've had some conversations with our institutions looking at how we can find a balance to that.
Ms. Castro, it doesn't cause just concern, it causes money.
It does cause money, correct.
Got it. No, thank you.
Yeah. I guess I could tell you an anecdotal story that former acting commissioner Monaghan told me about the gentleman in the bus stop. Windstorm's going, blowing snow, very cold out. He steps inside of a building to try and warm up. Bus comes by, misses the bus, and he ends up back in jail. The acting commissioner saying, "This is just crazy. This is not the only one. This is a program that this body is going to be seriously looking at." Go ahead.
On slide 15 is the Board of Parole.
Again, the PACE is operated under the Board of Parole as well, so there is a parole PACE program that's currently operating in Anchorage and Fairbanks. They have approximately 29 individuals that are currently participating in that program and another 14 that are pending. The parole board is made up of 6 budgeted positions along with 5 additional appointed positions by the governor. On slide 16 is the Division of Administrative Services.
Mr. Chair, just real quick, because they talk really fast and I write slow. Could you tell me, did you say that the governor put extra people in this program, in the budget? I thought at the end you said they were in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and that the governor put more positions in this program.
So the parole board is made up of 6 budgeted positions, and then there's also an additional 5 positions that are board members. They're not full-time positions, but they're appointed board members that oversee and are deciding members on the parole for parole hearings.
We'll follow up.
Representative Wilson.
Are they additional positions that are in the budget, and if so, how much more money is in here?
There's about 200, through the chair to Representative Wilson. There is about $200,000 that is appropriated for the board members. They are paid through what's considered a stipend.
I'm just trying to get short too. There's $200,000 extra that has been appropriated to the parole board, the difference from this year to from last year.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, no. Their budget is stagnant, and the only addition in that budget is associated with the salary increases of the 6 budgeted positions. The board members are not part of the salary adjustments that are applied through the contracts.
Okay, follow up.
Representative.
Okay, I thought you said there was additional money, but that's okay because you brought up something better. So you said that in here are the increases to the budget, and that has been taken out, correct? Because that wasn't everybody's supposed to take all that money out again this year. So will that be later on in the presentation where you took that money back out?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, yes. That is part of the $2.4 million unallocated that we are removing from the budgets.
And that you'll be allocating.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. And if we could, Commissioner, we've got the ignition interlock certification devices also. If we could have the same information that we're doing with the ankle bracelets to follow that up on, too, so we can look at the costs. Rep. Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, not only what it costs the state, but the other side, what it costs the client. Because my concern is if our clients can't afford it, then we're costing the state more. So thank you.
State just covers their cost. Thank you.
So within the Division of Administrative Services, we have the Budget and Finance Unit. We also are responsible for all of the inmate banking and the inmate funds that are brought into the department, as well as the auditing of all of those resources. Our human resource section, which is also responsible for ensuring Alaska Police Standards Council certification and training is applied, and they're also responsible and tasked with all employee background investigations. Procurement, we do have one. Our procurement officer is responsible for certifying the ignition interlock device. And then we also have the information technology, which is responsible for the ACOM system, and then our research and records and our facility CIP capital improvement unit. The overall budget is $8.5 million with 61 positions. On slide 17 is a breakout of how our offender population compares from 13 to 15. We want to take a look at the highlighted yellow area. We do and are experiencing just over a 6% reduction in our probation violations. That's through restructuring of our petitions to revoke, as well as some of the prior legislation. It leads us into the next slide, which is slide 18, which is where our offender population projections are currently at. On slide 18, the gray line represents where our projections were at about 3 years ago in FY13. The blue line represents what our capacity is, and again, that's with the 128 beds from Point McKenzie Farm. But the red line represents our adjusted population calculations based on the past legislation of HB 15 last year, the past legislation of SB 64, and the internal adjustments that we've done to our petitions to revoke.
You, Ms. Wilkerson, you mentioned a 6% reduction in what?
In our probation violations. So the individuals, to the chair, our probation violations, we have experienced a reduction in our population and just in our daily population of just over 6%.
How many people is that?
It's almost 400.
So 6% reduction on 400, so 24 people?
No, through the chair, I apologize. It's been almost 400 people that are no longer under custody of the department. So the 6% reduction is in comparing how, what we were operating and how we were in 13 versus now.
So 24 important people. Thank you. Rep. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many people aren't sitting in jail now because of HB 15? I'm sorry, you piqued my interest.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we're still gathering that on the statistics. We know that all three of those portions play a part in the reduced population that we're currently experiencing. We're working heavily to see and allocate out to which degree it is.
Follow up?
Wilson.
Is my understanding that there may be a third of the population that you can do because there's a third that are pretrial that are still sitting there? Just a suggestion. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of savings in it.
Thank you, Representative. Go ahead.
Slide 19. Slide 19 is just a comparison of our standing population by the type of crime, violent versus nonviolent, in 2002 as compared to today. And we continue to see that nonviolent percentage is a higher percentage of our population. Mm-hmm. On slide 20, is the percentages broken out. Again, it's a comparison from 2002 to 2015, and it shows the length of stay of that population makeup. On slide 21, it represents the same time period in comparison, only it's designated versus male versus female. The female population is continuing to outpace the male population. However, we have seen a slowing down from last year's increases. Slide 22 just represents the goals of the department, which continue to be protect the public by safe and secure care and custody, reducing the prison population and reducing recidivism. Slide 23 are some of our reentry outcomes that are currently in place. We are continuing to see an increased number of individuals that are successfully completing the court conditions that are set. Slide 24 is reflective of our efforts. We're continuing to try to successfully reenter individuals that are releasing from probation.
Sure. So, just if I may, I went through this exercise with the department in recent years. When you look at, like on page 23, we're going from 49 to 65%. It looks like a 15% reduction, but it's 15% of 6,000. So, that's 15, 6, that's not very many people. That's like 48 people. So it looks good and it sounds good, but it's really not very good. So, you know, and I only mention this, and I think you're really hearing the angst of this committee. We're trying very hard to reduce recidivism and help Alaskans get their life together. You know, the actions by this committee last year did even not, again, reduce the budget, I think is a good indicator of that. We had a recidivism reduction plan that we started 3 years ago. That was followed up by Pew, you know, partnering with Pew to create the Justice Recidivism Reform Plan. And what I didn't see in your recommendations is what in those plans you're going to implement.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if you want me to comment or not about
the... You're the commissioner. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure. The department's advance work and the bills that were passed to reduce probation violations is good work, and it's starting to get us there. The Pew work that we're going to do in coming up in Senate Bill 91 and dealing with the front-end work is good work. The EM work that needs to be done to make sure if we can do this and advance the efforts of that to for people who can be involved in EM, whether or not they can pay for it or not, is good work. So all of these efforts under my leadership is the reason why I'm here. I want these things to go forward. I want safer institutions, by the way, too. I want a lot safer institutions. But this work, this reform work on the justice system is very important to me. To the credit of the department, they have done work, and they have. We have shown on that one slide reductions in probation revocations. That's, and so I get it. And it's what I'm going to live and breathe.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Edgeman's been involved in these discussions. He knows those reports. He's very familiar with it. I'm confident in him to make sure he has follow-through on those implementations.
On slide 25 is reflective of those individuals who complete an institutional or a community-based substance abuse program. We currently have the 90-day program, which is the LSAT program, is what it's currently called. We have continued to increase those individuals that are not only participating but completing. And then we also have the residential substance abuse treatment program, which is the six-month program. And that is located in three locations, the Highland Mountain Correctional Center, the Palmer Correctional Center, and the Spring Creek Correctional Center.
How many inmates do you have, how many corrections prisoners do you have come in that have a sentence that's less than 90 days?
To the chair, we're going to have to get that information. I don't have that right.
Half? 25%?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the exact number, but yes. Under 90 days is a pretty small percentage. Many of those go through other alternative programs, so we don't have a lot of the under 90 days. But we will get those numbers specifically.
The point I'm trying to make is you have treatment programs, but they're 90 days and 6 months. And the person who's getting arrested on heroin once a month, going through your system, clogging up this system, they don't get 90-day sentences. 90% of all the cases that go through the courts in Matsu are drug-related. Mm-hmm. They don't get those 90-day sentences, but those are the people that need the treatment. But you don't have any programs that offer treatment for them. Thank you. Representative Gaddis.
I guess on that same note, it begs the question, so at what point does the treatment kick in? Let's say you're in jail for 2 years. Do you do it at the tail end, or do you have the opportunity to start the moment that you get sentenced?
Through the chair, that's a really good question, and there is an answer to that. Just so you know, I'm 8 months into this department, but I came from health and social services 20 years. So the issues of behavioral health are very near and dear to me. And I can tell you, first off, that I work more with substance abuse and mental health in Department of Corrections than I did within the Division of Behavioral Health, day in and day out. One of the things that I have noticed, because the other part of what I was brought on to do, was to help start moving the reentry issues forward. One of the barriers we have is that we cannot force someone into treatment. We can request them to do treatment. We can encourage them to do treatment. We cannot say, you must do treatment. With that said, we should be assessing them as soon as they are in the door. My belief about reentry is we do not wait until the end. We start the minute they are in our facility, start assessing them, building a plan for them, saying what they need, where they need to go, and then we need to be doing a better job of incentivizing why they need treatment. One of the other things that I do is I have the lucky assignment of being able to review every furlough termination appeal. So when someone goes out on furlough, they get remanded back for oftentimes alcohol and drugs or sometimes other things, but it's usually technical violations. The individual then has an ability to appeal. I can't tell you how many times those appeals that come back that are substance abuse related, the person has not had any substance abuse treatment while in our facility. So what I've started doing is then saying, okay, I'm going to deny your appeal with conditions, and if you get an assessment and if you follow the terms of that assessment for the LSAT program, the RSAT program, then you may consider a furlough again. So we have got to start using the tools, and I would prefer that we use them before they go out on furlough. Start using those, that if you want to get furlough, you really need to take advantage of these programs so that we can build that and have a healthier group of people moving out. Then the other thing we need to do is look at how do we, you know, we all know about treatment and addictions and recovery. It is not a one-shot treatment and you're done. That it takes often multiple treatments. It also takes aftercare, and it takes ongoing support services such as the 12-step programs that we talked about. So that is my goal, is that we start earlier. We incentivize them to get the treatment so that when they are ready to furlough, when they're eligible either for furlough or EM, that they are able to go out because they are healthier.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Gaddis.
So I would agree with the speaker that she's on the right track, but you didn't answer my question.
I'm sorry.
So I'll say it very succinctly. Do we give the treatment on the front end, or do we allow it close to the back end? Just very, very, very
through the chair. It can start as soon as they are in and they've been assessed. It usually does not, but we can and should.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is, sorry, Mr. Chair, through the chair, we could work on that. We could do a far better job of, and anybody who's been a mother, I'm here to tell you, we know how to incentivize better behavior. So we can do that. I mean, I'm hoping that the commissioner's listening loud and clear. And I certainly have heard from folks within that their opportunity to take these programs really doesn't exist till close to the back end, if at all. So, you know, whether I'm hearing anecdotal information from those within, we could do a better job. And I think that's what we're saying. Thank you.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what I think most of us are hearing, Representative Gaddis. So, Commissioner, can we get a report on what programs you do offer, what their costs are, and an evaluation of the success of those success rate of those programs?
Including the 12 step.
Go ahead.
Next one.
Yeah.
On slide 26 is a reference of the sex offender probations who have completed a sex offender management program and who have received a polygraph testing while on probation. There are currently 494 individuals that are participating. There were 812 exams that were given during 2015 that resulted in 95 petitions to revoke probation.
Rep. Wilson?
I'm sorry, I would not have put this as one of my slides. But anyway, so you're basing something, and I'm not exactly sure whether it's success or not, on how good of a liar those who are sex offenders are. Because we know polygraph testing isn't 100% surety. So are you saying because they passed a polygraph test, they're somehow safer? Again, I wouldn't have put this slide in. What are we trying to prove here?
Yeah, no, so, through the chair, Representative Wilson. The theory on polygraph monitoring of sex offenders is deterrence factor, that if you're conducting polygraph examinations, you're more likely to catch somebody who's starting to step down a dangerous road, who is associating with children when they're not allowed to associate with children, and you catch those individuals. The limits on that deterrent or that there are limits in that strategy, but the strategy has merit, at least I know it's been used in the juvenile system. We don't do polygraphs on juveniles, but the whole point is you're deterring, you're requiring people to tell you where they've been, what they're doing, et cetera, and so you can either catch people in lies. It's not foolproof, that's for certain, but it's an attempt to deter offenders from going places where they shouldn't be going.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So if I'm a good liar, what does this get me? I mean, so if I pass through and I'm doing things I'm not supposed to, but you look at my polygraph and I pass it, what's my reward? I get out sooner, I'm just trying to figure out what the slide is measuring.
Go ahead. No, it is an effort to deter future violations. It is not, someone might be successfully able to lie on a polygraph, I'm not debating that. But the strategy on polygraph examinations for sex offenders is to try to catch them if, in fact, they are places or doing things they shouldn't be. It's not foolproof. But
I'd like to get the cost and the scientific data that we would even use something like this.
Rep. Wilson, if I may, I just happen to be my piece of legislation that put that in. So I'm pretty familiar with it. And when we did that, it was Senator Bundy who was on the senator's side at the other half of that. We looked at the mandatory polygraphs pretty heavily. It's been shown that it dramatically reduces additional offenses. And the problem with sex offenders is they feel that what they're doing is perfectly fine. So the best way to try and prevent that is to do the polygraph test. And nothing's perfect, but it's the best tool that we had at the time to try and prevent that. But it was also the intent that the offenders that have to do the polygraph test had to cover their own costs. Are those costs being reimbursed to the state?
To the chair, they are not. The department found that individuals were skipping the polygraph and we were re-incarcerating because they couldn't afford to pay for the polygraph. And even though there was no additional threat at that time. And so currently the department is covering all the costs. There are some individuals in the community that are paying when it's mandated, and I would need to get that information from the contractors.
I believe the recidivism rate for sex offenders is about 92%. It's very, very high. And for me to hear that they just don't want to come do the test, so you don't make them do the test or arrest them, that's a pretty poor excuse for protecting Alaskans from probably one of the most heinous crimes you could have affected on you. These are crimes that affect people for the rest of their life. And to hear that you're not making inmates who are sentenced for sexual assault to minors, mm-hmm. not having to do the mandatory polygraph testing because they don't want to or can't afford, I didn't really hear a reason, I don't think, of why you don't make them. Or I guess you throw them back in jail or... Well, we were running out of time, and so we can get into this issue, and I'll talk to the commissioner later on it, and we'll make sure we get it wound up. But we're getting tight. We still got to get the Department of Law through here. So, members, if we can allow the department to finish off the presentation, that'd be good. And you don't have to do the ones from the Department of Ledge Finance.
On slide 27, it is a reflection of the current number of completed GED certifications that have been issued. In 2014, the department implemented the federal regulation in January of 2014, which did greatly reduce the number of individuals completing a GED. We did have some issues last fiscal year through technology and equipment and infrastructure that we have addressed, and we are back on track. We anticipate getting that back up and 100% operational throughout the rest of the fiscal year. On slide 28, the department continues to be faced with the same challenges and issues, meeting the 24/7 operational needs, connecting soon-to-be-releasing offenders to the community-based resources, and the continued growth of the female and the mentally ill population. On slide 29, the medical costs have continued to increase. It has increased another 3.2% over FY14, which is 0.8% more than the U.S. national average. And then we continue to have an increasing chronic health issues with the aging inmate population that's within the department's custody.
Thank you. Well, Commissioner, you had a pretty good workover today, but I think it's only because this committee is so concerned about the issues that face the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chairman, if I may comment, one brief moment.
Very briefly.
Yep. I get it. I hear it. I understand it. The buck does stop now with me. I take the job very seriously. I have stormy seas ahead of me on several fronts. I know this budget piece. I want this to be better, and my dedication to you is that we're going to get there. Ask for your patience while I learn the department better than I know it right now. But I hear the frustration, and I want this to be better. That's why I'm here.
Thank you, Mr. Patience is running thin, so let's get it done. Mm. Thank you. We're going to take a brief, very brief at ease while the Department of Law comes up. Thank you. We're going to call the House Finance Budget Subcommittee back to order. We have an overview by the Department of Law. Commissioner Richards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To start off our presentation today, I thought I'd share with the committee the major changes that we've made within leadership within the Department of Law since the last year. Rick Savodny, who was the longtime head of the Criminal Division, retired in July, and as a budget-cutting measure, we did eliminate the position and move Jim Cantor, who's been the longtime head of the Civil Division, over both divisions. So that was a change within the department and one we're monitoring, and I think so far has been a success for a number of reasons. The other big change is that Nancy Gordon, who is the director of the Civil Division, also retired this summer and has been replaced by Steve DeVries, who's been an attorney with the department for about 28 years and has worked in a number of different sections and breeds. Not only a breadth of legal experience, but also a very in-depth knowledge of the Civil Division itself to the position.
Members, if we could let the department go through their overview, and then we'll have questions at the end.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I had an idea of the amount of time, I could know when to speed up or slow down. Do we have about half an hour or 15 minutes? Or
maybe completes their work at 3:30, so you got 20 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the core services that the department provides are protecting the safety and financial well-being of Alaskans, fostering conditions for responsible development of natural resources, and protecting the fiscal integrity of the state of Alaska, and promoting good governance. Those are basically the core mission statements of the Department of Law. And I think the first one of these, one of our core missions is protecting Alaskans. I think the key thing I'd like to make the committee aware of, just in terms of things that have changed since the last time everybody had a chance to see this presentation, is we've had a dynamic growth in the number of China cases. In fact, China cases are up approximately 55% in the last year. In addition, we've had a large increase in China appeals. Now, it may seem that 34 to 25 isn't a huge number, but these appeals are very labor-intensive for the Department of Law. And in addition, from the Department of Law's perspective, they're particularly inefficient use of resources. It's very rare that an appellant wins one of these cases. And because the Public Defender Agency and the Department of Law represents both sides, effectively, the state of Alaska is paying both sides of the load. So we've committed to working with OCS and really trying to get behind and understanding why we're seeing the growth in the China cases, as well as with public defenders to understand what's driving the increase. Because in an environment of decreased budgets, we can't have 55% year-to-year growth in China cases.
And Mr. Attorney General, for the record, China, a child in need of aid.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. And with that, I'll turn over the next two slides to John Skidmore, the Director of the Criminal Division. John, if you're online.
I'm not seeing, yep.
Mr. Skidmore, if you can hear us, please chime in with your name and your testimony.
John Skidmore.
A little closer to the mic so we can hear you louder.
Sorry, this is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. Can you hear me all right?
We hear you. Okay, thank you, sir. Proceed.
So on slide five, what you all have is the number of cases that are referred to us and the number of cases that we've accepted during calendar years 13 through 15. The point of the slide is really on the top graph you have felonies, and you can see that the number of felonies referred to us has remained fairly constant. The number of cases that we have declined as felonies has increased as the years have gone on, and that's really a reflection in the reduction of our budget, which is 85% personnel, meaning that effectively to reduce our budget, we have to cut positions. And when we cut prosecutors, it means we simply can't do as much work. And so you see a reflection of that in the first graph on felonies. The point that I want to make from this slide is that in misdemeanors, which you see down below, though there has been a decrease in the referrals provided to us, the declination rate has almost doubled from a 7.4 to a 13.8. The significance of that for us is that though our resources are dwindling, you notice that we are not declining as many felonies as we are misdemeanors because we are still trying to focus on those crimes that get us the biggest bang for our buck and try to focus on the protection of the public. One of the things you don't have on these slides are conviction rates, but I know that that's something that also matters to many of you. I can tell you that in 2014, we had a conviction rate around 80% for our felonies and right around 73% for our misdemeanors. I don't yet have numbers for 15. We are trying to tease that out of our new case management system, and when I get those, I'm happy to provide them if anyone wants them.
Thank you.
I would then turn to slide six. And for slide six, again, following the same thread of we are focusing our resources on the cases that matter most, I know that sexual assault and sexual abuse of minors are cases that are very important to many of you on the committee there. They are very important to prosecutors and to many of the citizens all across the state of Alaska. And though you'll see that there is a higher percentage of declinations for these than there are for typical felonies, that unfortunately is just a result of these cases being so difficult to prosecute. But the point that I want to drive home for these slides and for these particular graphs is that even at a time when we have had a decrease in the number of prosecutors that are available to us, you will see that there is also a decrease in the number of declinations. That is, we are accepting more and more of these cases because we are trying to get as aggressive as possible in prosecuting these cases because we know that these are the ones that matter the most.
Thank you.
The other thing that I would note, and I don't have a slide for this particularly, but one of the other things that will be happening for the Criminal Division in this year's proposed budget is the closure of the Dillingham office. And the first thing that I would say about this is that there is nobody in the Criminal Division or within the Department of Law that finds that to be an ideal situation. Having lived and prosecuted out in Dillingham for many years myself, I can attest to the value of having someone in the community. But unfortunately, the economy both last year and this year doesn't leave us in a place that we can live in ideals. We have to live with practical realities, And unfortunately, those practical realities mean that we have to cut our budgets. The statistics that I provided you on the number of cases that are declined are statewide statistics. I share those because our declinations are statewide, not in one office or another, not in one region of the state, but statewide. And unfortunately, we have to cut something. And we have 85% personnel, 10% fixed cost, only 5% discretionary costs. So what that means is that when we cut, we really effectively have to cut personnel, but we don't want to simply cut personnel. We also need to cut those fixed costs. Fixed costs are things like leases. We need to find leases that we can no longer have to support. Barrow was one that we used in last year. Unfortunately, this year, we believe Dillingham is one that is appropriate for us. Both of those locations are chosen because they are satellite offices of a larger office that is able to absorb the work from that community, not to suddenly just diss the community, not to no longer pay them any attention, but to give them the same attention that all other cases receive, and there is an office capable of absorbing that. Fairbanks for Barrow, Anchorage for Dillingham. The other things that I would say about Dillingham is that we have IT challenges out there, and the IT challenges for Dillingham included needing a new phone system, an extremely slow internet, and creates other problems for us. While we know there will be an increase in travel costs, that increase is offset by the fact that for Dillingham, grand juries occurred in Anchorage. So what's being offset is the attorney no longer needs to travel to Anchorage for grand jury. They would already be here in Anchorage for grand jury. What they will need to do is travel to Dillingham. Much like the attorney that's currently assigned to Dillingham, a 20-year prosecutor is there today trying a domestic violence felony assault case with a repeat offender, because that's our commitment to the Dillingham community, is to ensure that we send people out there and ensure that we continue to battle those cases. The difference in the cost, as we estimated, our travel costs will go up about $27,000, $21,000. That's not a small amount, but when you compare it to the over $190,000 that we will save, it just makes logical financial sense. The other thing that I can say is that the new courthouse posed problems for us as well. It moved from its previous location to across town. That means that we now have commuting time to get to that location. It also means that our lawyer spends more time out of the office for those reasons, and it meant that we would have had to have a vehicle in Dillingham. In addition, the new courthouse actually has two courtrooms so that they can do two trials simultaneously. Yeah. Leaving a single attorney in Dillingham means they can't do two trials.
Mr. Birdsall? Ms. Blaidsall?
Mr. Skidmore, I think the chair would like to move on to the next slide.
Please.
So, my apologies. By all means, please do so.
Just for the members, it mentions here in the bullet point, defending Alaska's right to manage its resources. When I had discussions with the Department of Law on this, discussion went to whether they can afford to do some of the lawsuits that they're involved in right now. I asked the commissioner to get a report back to us on which ones he was talking about and their costs. We were also in contact with Senator Sullivan's office. Senator Sullivan, former Attorney General, former Department of Natural Resources Commissioner, is to make sure we can continue to protect the state's rights from federal oversight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cantor?
Yes, Jim Cantor, Deputy Attorney General. And on that same slide of fostering economic development, as Representative Newman alluded, we are looking at new matters as they come in the door with a sharp eye to make sure that Alaska is going to get the appropriate pushback against the federal government or other economic benefit out of a lawsuit. But there's some going on now that are we're carrying forth quite excitedly. The Sturgeon argument last week in the U.S. Supreme Court, one of our lawyers argued that along with Mr. Sturgeon's lawyer. The Big Thorn timber sale, which is one that the lower court upheld the sale, and it's now before the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit argument was held today. There's an RS-2477 case going on in the MATSU. The EPA, which tried to regulate utilities nationwide in a way that would have added to every Alaskan's cost, we pushed back saying this rule might be fine for big integrated utilities outside. It's not designed for Alaska. The EPA backed away. So those cases are ongoing. The next slide, slide 8, protecting fiscal integrity. The first bullet there has to do with the gas line. I'm going to turn that over to Attorney General Richards.
Mr. Chairman, so on the gas line, currently where we stand is we got a pretty substantial supplemental budget amendment in the last special session. Currently, in this fiscal year, we had appropriated approximately $13 million for outside counsel. Of that, we have approximately $8 million has yet to be spent, which means we spent about $5 million. We do expect that spend rate to go up once we start making progress in getting some of the documents negotiated. I think we're beginning to see that. Last week or two, I think, has been very encouraging in AKLNG, so I do expect that burn rate to increase. So on the gas line, that from loss perspective, that's primarily it, that we do have about $8 million left, so I think we're well-funded to meet our targets for this year.
The same slide, protecting fiscal integrity. A couple of things that emerged from that. One is we had a program cut. One of the programs that we did was child support enforcement, where the idea is if you get orders requiring people to pay their child support, then you don't have a family that lands on the public public purse. The federal program that we were working off of had a bizarre consequence that people who could otherwise afford a lawyer could still take advantage of the program. So we worked with Revenue and Department of Law and the federal government, and we've now cut that program to aim it at the people who it will benefit the public purse. So we've cut three lawyers out of that six-lawyer program. Other things that we do to protect the fiscal integrity is that don't show up as the statistics on the slide, which are money statistics we can brag about, but it's the defensive things. A taxpayer is told they owe X, they say, no, we owe Y, and we push back on that. There's a case in the Supreme Court now that goes back to the ELF taxation days where there's $500 million in play. Injured people sue the state, saying the state damaged them in one way or another, and the state owes this, and we push back, and we may be pushing back, we don't owe you a penny, or we may be pushing back saying you're exaggerating your damages. That's the kind of defense that we do daily to protect the public fisc. The next slide, promoting good governance. We defend the laws that you pass. We defend ballot measures. We provide advice to all the state agencies and defend actions against those agencies. That takes us to slide 10, where I'm going to pass the baton back to
you. Let's just go right to 14.
Sorry.
The other is just ledge finances. Numbers, we've seen those. The members have questions, they can ask it later.
Yep, I'm there. So I think
it's this one.
Yep, I got it. Okay. So I think a key point on this first bullet point is that about half of the civil division is funded by RSAs rather than general funds. And one of the things I think worth noting is that in general fund expenditures, we've had a decrease of 10%.
Mr. Richards?
Yes.
We don't use acronyms. If we can avoid them here. So just that's fine, receipt services agreements, but
okay.
Try and stay away from that. There's members of the public who are listening in, and we live in a world of acronyms. We're trying to help them understand.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the receipt service agreements, the point that I wanted to make was just that our general fund budget has fallen by 10% last year, and we're proposing an 8% drop this year. Our total budget, all funds considering, and this is excluding the big gas line appropriation, has fallen about 7% in the prior year, and we're posing a 5% cut. What this demonstrates is that our general fund is being cut faster than our RSA, our receipt service agreement funds, which is just a reflection of that our own general fund is being reduced at a rate faster than agencies are asking for our services. Obviously, with receipt service agreements, we're really a service taker as opposed to a maker. We provide our clients the services they seek and ask for, and we bill them appropriately. So I think that was just a point worth making, is that that part of our budget is really driven by agency decisions and policies. And 2 points that I made last year, which I think are worth repeating to this committee, is that when agencies do cut, it's not surprising that the receipt service agreements aren't necessarily reducing right away, because oftentimes to reduce on the agency side does have an uptick in legal work. So we would expect the receipt service agreements parts of our budget, if there are substantial cuts, to roll through maybe a couple years later as, you know, you decommission some of the big mega projects and some other things that have costs associated with closing. And the final point on this slide that, again, was made to this committee last year was that we focus very hard on, even in a period of cuts, that we not – that agencies don't feel that they shouldn't be coming to us for front-end advice. This is the idea of a pound of prevention. You know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That oftentimes the cheapest way to use your lawyer is on the front end, not the back end in litigation. So we continue to encourage our agency clients to, in particular, seek front-end advice on major decisions. In this slide, I think this goes through some of the strategies, some of which we've talked about, including closing of Dillingham. The one that has been in the news and is incorporated into our budget is that we are proposing the creation of a public integrity unit within special prosecutions. The Office of Special Prosecutions is housed within the criminal division. In the past year or two, we have cut that by several lawyers, and we've cut it a little deeply. So as we're adding lawyers back in, we've thought through how do we restructure it a little bit to provide better services and issues related to officer-involved shootings, correction deaths, and allegations of public corruption. So you'll see that that's about a $700,000 cost. About half of that we're proposing we absorb through internal transfers. And about half, although it's not a budget increase, we didn't quite make the governor's OMB's suggested budget cuts, because about $350,000 of that is something less than the total decrease that OMB asked for.
We're trying to help you out. Representative, we'll take questions after the presentation,
okay.
Please.
So unless we want to get into the specific budget numbers, that was the sum total of the presentation.
Go through your budget numbers. I think it's important that the public sees, you know, your budget and what's going on there.
Okay. I was going to call it Mr. Blaisdell, if that's okay.
Through the chair, I'm Dave Blaisdell. I'm the Admin Services Director for the Department of Law. And if you want to go to the next two slides there. So in developing our FY17 budget, we, of course, started with the FY16 Conference Committee. The main changes that occurred had to do with the unallocated reduction as a result of the salary increases that came through a special session. To achieve that reduction, we did close the Barrow office. That was two positions, and we estimated about $400,000 savings. We did a change in the way we did business with the Alaska Oil Gas Conservation Commission, and we're having them pay for the services that we used to pay cover those services out of our general fund. Those are now being paid for with AOGCC receipts. And then we've had several employees within the department who had let us know they were going to have some extended absences, so we calculated that in, and we've also have a furlough built into the FY16 at this point to get to the 302. Bring our total FY17 budget to $89,015,000, excuse me. And then for FY17, we've reduced our outside counsel by $500,000. We added the capacity that the Attorney General spoke to in OSPA for the $318,000. We've also transferred tariff work in RAPA, or to Regulatory Affairs Public Advocacy Section, and we've been able to do a fund source switch of, $600,000, where that'll be paid for by the RCA receipts. We are anticipating, again, the mandatory furloughs. We've got the closing of the Dillingham office, a savings of 340. We have staff reductions of 564.5, and then the reversal of the COLA that we're working on that's an unallocated at this point. To associate them a little better with the divisions, this is the criminal division. In the criminal division, for FY17, the big issues were the closing of the Dillingham office and then the unallocated reductions in the furloughs. Above that, you can see several of the reductions that we've absorbed in the last several years. And then on the next slide, in the civil division, we have the $500,000 reduction to the outside council dollars, and then the unallocated positions that we are still working to identify. Our approach with some of our reductions has been to try to eliminate positions through attrition, and for the most part, we've been able to do that. Last year, we did have some positions that we laid off, mainly in the criminal division. We did have one in the civil division. But our goal, of course, would be to try to retain that. And then finally, we have the furloughs in the civil division. And this is just a slide for your info on the merger of our oil, gas, and mining with the natural resources section. And I'll show you how we walk through the numbers.
Thank you. Representative Guerra, followed by Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've always found it curious, Attorney General Richards, that we spend time accounting to bill other agencies for work that one agency does, and so yours does it more than any other agency probably. You bill the Department of Natural Resources for work that you do, but it's all the same money. So, I mean, what's really the purpose of going through that accounting mechanism? I mean, and it seems like I see it as a waste of time personally, but you can convince me otherwise.
Representative Guerra, you know, my particular nature is I'm a lover of cost accounting. So I would say that I think it actually makes a lot of sense, because what it does is it means that if there is known and recognizable cost to governmental agencies using law's services, then there is an incentive for them to use them efficiently. Whereas, of course, if you provide, you know, essentially free services to everybody, there's no incentive for them to sort of do their own work or reduce the work when, you know, maybe they could do it internally or maybe not file lawsuits that don't make that much sense from an economic perspective. So I think that I like the Department of Law's use of sort of the private law firm model where, you know, direct agency costs get passed back on to the agency, so they have to make some economic decisions about using our services.
Through the chair.
Yeah, I think we have others who have questions, so if you could ask it briefly, Representative.
Don't worry about it.
Go ahead.
No.
Go ahead, ask it.
No.
Go ahead.
It's fine.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the closing of the Dillingham and the Bauer offices, you're still at times going to have to send people out there. Why don't you close or lay off an attorney in the Anchorage office and bring the AGs in from Dillingham or Barrow as more effective? I mean, it's cheaper to put somebody up in a hotel in Anchorage than temporarily put somebody up in Dillingham or Barrow for an extended period of time. Why don't you reverse it that way? Or are you going to do things more telephonically?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. So two parts of that. The first one is, I would point out, and I don't have the statistics with me, but I'll have them provided to you. If you look at the number of positions, which are over 20 that we've cut in the last year or two, most of them were from Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, the vast, vast majority of them. It's just, of course, the cuts that occur at Dillingham and Barrow and Kotzebue, they are much more proportional impacts because, you know, you cut one of three, it's a lot more proportional impact than it is cutting five of 30. So in that sense, I do think we've tried to balance the relative cuts of our smaller offices versus our larger offices. In terms of answering the specific question of have we looked at the economic impact of these offices, I think the criminal division has been fairly robust in their analysis in trying to figure out what is the most cost-effective way to deliver prosecutorial legal services. And you know, as Mr. Skidmore said, it wasn't easy to
It's never easy to let somebody go. It's certainly never easy to let an office go, particularly prosecutors, because they're sort of the hub of, you know, public safety in many ways in these small communities. But we tried to balance all the competing factors, including cost.
Just to follow through, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. Just from the perspective of having somebody stationed in one of those communities facilitates justice at a higher level when they're actually part of the community and they know the nuances instead of having somebody come in and having to just pick it up and figure it out. So, you know, knowing what's going on in a community, knowing the source of the problem, recommendations for treatments as compared with a jail time, I think in some ways those are there's facilitating better justice for the state. Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on page 4, when we're talking about civil division and OCS cases and the rise of those cases, do you believe if those were criminal cases versus civil cases that would change the number of cases?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I believe these are all civil cases the way the...
No, they are all civil cases. Right. The question is, if they had to be criminal cases versus civil, because you're talking about a big change in what proof you would have to have, do you believe that these numbers would be this high because civil cases have such a lower threshold?
Representative Wilson, if you know, they would be much lower if you applied a criminal standard to China cases.
Follow up?
Representative Wilson.
I can't help myself. So if you're taking someone's child, okay, and that's what they do, don't you think, as the Attorney General of the state of Alaska, that to do something that drastic, we shouldn't have it under criminal versus civil?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I don't know. I've never given a thought, but I will say that I view my job is to fully and faithfully enforce the laws of the state of Alaska. So whatever this body chooses to do, I certainly will enforce those laws.
And follow up?
Rep. Wilson.
The reason you don't have appeals is because of the public defenders, like you just said, the public defenders. So basically the state's sitting on both sides. This is my opinion, not the Finance Committee, but at least in Fairbanks, public defenders are really not very good that I've seen, and therefore they probably wouldn't appeal. So my question is that if, let's say, we had more private attorneys and those appeals increased, are you ready for that kind of growth?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, no.
we're
cutting our budget. We're not increasing it. So we'll meet the challenges that face us. But if appeals increase, it would be a challenge.
I think they're going to. And one last question.
Rep. Wells.
So on your integrity unit, I think that's an awesome idea. So in the integrity unit, I'm assuming that those who are upset with the OCS process, that they'll be able to put their complaints into the integrity unit, and you will see whether or not they are utilizing their resources and doing their job or not?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the public integrity unit is currently thought to be configured, will handle accusations of public corruption, officer-involved shootings, and deaths in correctional facilities. So the only way we would be involved in a China-related matter is if, in fact, it was an allegation of public corruption.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be very easy to put towards, so I look very forward to passing that word on.
Thank you. Representative Edgman, followed by Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I want to surprisingly commend the department on the good work they do. And I don't say that facetiously, because you do a lot of great work. You actually bring in a lot of money to the state for the work that you do. I don't think that should be underemphasized. But on the DA office closure in Dillingham, I think everyone here knows my version of that. I find that to be highly unconscionable, given that I live out in the area. I know what the impacts are. I also know that as a state agency, you're not able to measure the true impacts on the people in the region by doing it. You can look at a piece of paper and say it's going to save you $191,000, and therefore it fits in your budget guidelines. But I'm just looking at some notes here. We just had a major drug dealer in Dillingham have to plead down from a felony to a misdemeanor. $19,000 in cash they found him in Dillingham in December. And I can't tie that directly to a lack of a local DA out there, but that's not the first incident. It won't be the last incident. So I'm going to close by putting this question out just for consideration. I don't expect a response back. But you can't always measure the cost of services in dollars and cents. And in a $54 million UGF department that cut $191,000 out of an agency where we get a thousand out of a region where we get 1,000 cases a year, in the, one of the largest fisheries in the world in the summertime. I just don't get it, and I'm not done fighting it. And I expect to have this conversation again with the gentleman at the table and with others here in the building as well, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for allowing me to be a diplomatic for a moment.
Look forward to the conversation. Thank you, Representative. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I will continue to be diplomatic as well. Both the previous speaker and Representative Guttenberg have made the arguments about the value of having a full slate of law enforcement personnel and resources in a community. And they've made the argument that there is an undefinable, something that cannot be measured by dollars and cents, in having that value. And I do hear Mr. Skidmore and the commissioner here acknowledging that value. The difficult thing is our committee's responsibility is to allocate scarce resources. We deal in dollars and cents, and we have an obligation to everybody who comes before us asking for money for their programs to make the most transparent and demonstrable and understandable comparison of the costs and benefits. There are of necessity in a zero-sum game like a budget, winners and losers. It sounds like the department has made a good faith effort to mitigate the impacts and to have reductions be allocated fairly with a close eye on the overall mission. And I think they're doing a good job in a very difficult process and difficult situation, which is a situation we all find ourselves in. Thanks.
Comments? Any other comments or questions from the committee? Thank you. Good work today. I think we had a lot of good questions. We delved down into a couple of issues pretty deep. Good work from the committee members. Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Our next House Finance Committee meeting will be Thursday, February 4th at 1:30 p.m. here in this room, where we will have FY16 supplemental budget. That's House Bill 293. Pat Bitney, Director of Office of Management Budget, will make that presentation. And FY17 budget overview, Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. Thank you for your attendance.